And thank you for giving me the honor and gratification of actually reading this. being interested in it. I mean, I was telling Ben before that, not that I feel a little bit like an imposter, but it's just like this was such a thing from a particular period in my life, and it was like in the pandemic, and it's like one of those things that I had to get out of my system. And now that it's out there, it's kind of like, you know, not that I don't find it interesting or whatever, but there's just like other things now that I'm interested in dealing with. And so yeah. I was like nervous to come back to this, thinking it might be like really opaque or that I wouldn't understand it. And it's actually, it wasn't that. It was good. But
I honestly, I'm going to recommend this article to like, I know at least a half dozen people that I know for a fact need to read this article.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, just like lots, you know, however many people listen to this as well.
And I have a question. My caveat is maybe I don't need to do this, but that I'm not a professional academic or scholar. This was extracurricular activity. So just that to get out of the way that there was, and especially I think the piece that, you know, we might get to later, but piece I felt more uncomfortable with was it was kind of a qualification for the journal to be published, to kind of engage with more of the scholarship kind of around some of these themes. And that was when I was like, I don't necessarily want to, I'm a little out of my depth, but if we can talk about Marxism and Christianity, I'm there for it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't seem out of your depth at all.
No, you don't.
Maybe we should start by just,
talking
about what this is.
Well, maybe I can do the whole Chris.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. Ben is our substitute Chris. Our second string Chris.
Second string Chris here. Yeah. I mean, and then we can just basically talk like we have been
the
past few minutes, but, welcome to the Regrettable Century. Today we are having friend of the podcast on Daniel, who has a couple of years ago authored this really great paper we're going to discuss in the New Black Friars publication titled Ideology, Fetishism, Apophaticism, Marxist Criticism and Christianity. And we'll certainly link that in the show notes. Today it's me and Jason. And we are happy to finally have Daniel on. We had some snafus last time with our traverso, and so the ghostly presence you may have felt in that recording was Daniel.
Ontology this time.
In the last time we had a negation of Daniel, and now we have the negation of that negation.
Exactly.
Yep, that's it. We're done. We can be done.
There we go. Have a good day. I have a question right off the bat, which is just like about this journal. Explain the process of this. You know, like what went into how on earth did this come about besides just your interest or whatever?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. So the journal is New Black Friars, and it's a pretty fascinating academic journal that is an official wing of the English Dominican order. There's monks behind this. This was really just like when I was thinking about this paper, this was the only place I was thinking about. If it wasn't going to happen here, it was just going to live on my blog, right? I wasn't going to try to get this published anywhere, because this journal has a very special importance for me as a years ago I got really into, so I think it was in the 70s or 80s, but there's basically this tradition of Catholics from Ireland and the UK engaging with Marxist studies, and a lot of this discourse happened back then in this journal. There's another journal called Slant. And some of the main figures of that were Herbert McCabe, it's really fantastic, Dominican. Terry Eagleton is probably more well known as, written a bunch of stuff for Verso and things like that. And Dennis Turner is another one who's more of a theologian, but they're all Catholics and they're all Yeah, like so New Blackfriars is one of the organs of where this dialogue is happening. And it was, you know, back when this was kind of a thing, right? The Christian Marxist dialogue. And I have a lot of those articles in PDF. I'd be really happy to share those with whoever wants them. Some really great ones. One of my favorite is by Dennis Turner. It's called Can a Christian Be a Marxist? And so it's that kind of, it's operating at that kind of level, kind of like, can these two worldviews be reconciled? And the short answer is yes, you can. not only that, but in that particular paper, Dennis Turner says it's not only possible, but it's the only possible way to be a Christian within a capitalist society is precisely to be a Marxist.
Which harkens back to the what is it, the epigram page in the book Daniel and I recently read, Atheism and Christianity, right? Bloch says only an atheist can be a good Christian, only a Christian can be a good atheist. So
yeah,
I have that book on my reading list.
That's another quick thing I'll say is I did listen to the discussion you all had about Bloch with John.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic. So if you're listening to this, go listen to that, because so much overlap of themes.
There is. Why I was so excited about doing this. Yeah. It just seems like the spiritual successor, a natural next step is to talk in depth about a more concentrated and still kind of diffuse way of approaching what we've begun to talk about already.
Yeah. And so then just the kind of practical for how this paper came into being was, so there's a great little institute called the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto. And this is a small independent school that, you know, you can go do degrees there, but they also do just kind of continuing education seminars type thing. And so through another great podcast, the Magnificast, it's a podcast about Christianity and leftist politics. One of the co-hosts, Dean Detloff, was teaching at the school. And so he did a whole course on Marxism and Christianity. And so that's when just kind of doing that with other people, reading through a bunch of these texts, that my brain started to put things together. You know, this might be an interesting avenue to... specifically this idea of apophaticism, which I know we'll get into. There's a lot of highly technical big words, but I would just say as a kind of, there were two things I think this paper is trying to do maybe too many things, really a lot of things. It's kind of dense, but two of the main things were, one is on the side of Marxism and one is on the side of Christianity. And then I guess a third one is bridging, but the one on the side of Marxism was really just kind of like for my own understanding and thinking kind of like what's really going on in Capital, especially the first Capital Volume 1, the first few chapters, this whole piece about commodity fetishism, which is really easy to misunderstand. And there's a lot going on there, but kind of wanting to correct or push back against this maybe more common idea that like it's kind of an economic textbook, right? It's like describing, it's basically describing how socialism works or could work. And a lot of people in the 20th century did read it like that. I think one that comes to mind is Ernst Mandel, who, you know, not that I have anything wrong with him, but there's just like a way of reading Capital.
I have one thing that I find very wrong with him, which is that way of reading Capital.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that it's like to make this category mistake of reading this book as like a simple description of just like how socialist production and economy might work. And so the short answer to that is wrong. It's very there's a lot going on. And part of what's going on is figuring out how to actually read Marx, how to understand what he's doing philosophically. And that's where this amazing book comes in, which is The Philosophy of Marx by Etienne Balibar.
Oh, yeah.
So Balibar was a student of Louis Althusser and is one of the big project they did with Althusser and his students reading Capital. Balibar was involved in that. He's this French philosopher who this book is so explosive and great and totally just like outlook changing, because what he's doing is not he's not giving you the content of Marxist thought, right? He's showing you the form of how Marx thinks,
right?
What it actually means to be a in scare quotes, dialectical thinker.
So it's not like a checklist of positions you have to have and that makes you a Marxist.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's really hard to describe and talk about, because it's precisely because Marx is a dynamic thinker, and he, you know, like writers like David Harvey talk about like capital as a totality, and to try to understand what is going on when you dissect and talk about a totality is that it's kind of this ever revolving, shifting thing. You come at it from 100 different angles. All in some ways, every beginning is a new revolution, a new turning, a new way of seeing it.
Yeah.
It's never static. To fix it statically is to immediately lose the overall point, which is that it's this changing dynamic thing, which capital is. So to understand a changing dynamic thing, you have to be a changing dynamic thinker. So like that was all one sphere of thinking. And then I hit on this really, there's a chapter in this book called Ideology or Fetishism. And this is just like super fascinating as a Marxist or as a kind of like way of approaching how Marxist thought changes. So Althusser is kind of, you know, known for arguing this break, a radical break between the early humanist Marx, who is all concerned about alienation and human essence and kind of subjectivity. And at some point he undergoes a break where then he becomes this objective. He's looking at the market forces, capital. And, you know, it's to go back, we'll probably go back to Ernst Bloch many times, but it's the whole warm current, cold current kind of thing.
I know several people who like love that interpretation because it kind of justifies their, let's say, frigidity.
The Althusserian?
Yeah.
I would say that idea that
the young Marx is good. It's like very motivated, you know, it's what you want in the young person. But it's really the older, the mature Marx, the intelligent Marx, the one who really figured things out. That's the one to really pay attention to.
And they, yeah.
They're seen as like, you don't need to go back to the young Marx ever again, because the mature Marx is the really valuable one. Actually, they are two separate people.
I think they're the way that they dualize young and old Marx has an analog to the way that they dualize like the sort of communist tradition prior to Marxism or religion, you know, all of it. You know, it's like, oh, all of that stuff is good, the human spirit and all that. And I think that what we're talking about, this sort of schismatic dissection, is the orthodox Marxist position today, the Althusserian structuralist position that says that he outgrew it. It's all
it is the orthodox. It is the let's say the contemporary the mainstream Marxist interpretation. But it's, you know, it's not even as clear as it is, as though like it's not based upon an interpretation and appreciation for Althusser. It's like it's downstream of that, of Althusser even thinking that. Most people aren't even aware that that is a concept, which is because of a person.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, there's a side note to attach to that. And I want to be careful of, I think some people also kind of wrongly accuse Engels of, you know, there's from the other side of that, there can be a kind of this whole narrative of Engels kind of corrupted some of Marx's teachings or whatever, made it this more scientific objective. I don't think that, but I do think another thing just to acknowledge that's important is that kind of within the Marxist tradition itself, within Marx himself, there is this kind of combativeness. There is this superiority that is, you know, you can't get rid of that. There's some uncomfortable things that are true of these traditions that are still really important. But one of them is like, a little bit of that, you know, we have the correct interpretation. We're going to sort of eviscerate everyone else. So I just think that's also important to note. But but definitely to go back to that, I think the more common thing is that kind of assumption that the objective is morally better way to understand that. And so what's intriguing about this book, Balibar's book, is he doesn't say there isn't a break or transformation, but he kind of softens it by saying Marx is dealing with similar things, but in different languages or different frameworks. And so he's using different metaphors. His concerns might appear a little different, but that at base, we're still trying to understand the same sorts of things. And so as an example of that, he uses this concept of from the idol to the fetish, or from ideology to fetishism. And so just to give a brief example of what that is. So ideology he associates with the earlier Marx, and that, you know, in earlier works like the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts, you know, his interaction with Feuerbach, he's really dealing with this concept of ideology. And, you know, ideology is not how we use it today, just kind of political ideologies. It's this very kind of technical argument of how class society operates and works.
Right,
and
right.
So there's this doubling or reflecting of the real world in these kind of noumenal, this kind of cloud of discourse. And the way he talks about it is very much as a part connected to class, sort of like these discourses of class society. So the state, religion, right? These things that are kind of very directly linked to social class and how those classes oppress, but how the outlook and language used is makes it kind of appear nebulous.
Well, yeah, a lot of people understand it as like it's all deliberate outgrowths of the ideology itself,
right? Which is to totally misunderstand the nature of capital.
Yeah,
right. And so the short like summary of that would be I think of it as a more top down. Like you kind of start from the realization of class division, and then you investigate. You know, the classic example of this is like concepts like freedom, right? What does freedom mean? Well, in America, we have this idea of what we think freedom is, but when you kind of start to pick apart that concept, I think very quickly start to see that freedom is just kind of like this way of how the ruling class, like people that are have this kind of position of power and oppression, use freedom to as this kind of force to kind of like bolster up their own class, if that makes sense. So yeah. It's kind of this like starting from that position at the top and then seeing how it kind of like circles back around to that. So that's on the one pole. And then what he calls the shift to fetishism is then this kind of like starting from the bottom up. And so this is a really interesting move, I think, because it the way he talks about it is like in Capital, he's and Marx even says this in the very opening parts of Capital, that I'm starting from the smallest atom of capitalism, which is the commodity. There's no capitalism without the commodity. What is the commodity? You start from that lowest thing and then you're building up. And it's really interesting, the shift in framework, how that allows you to see things differently. And so what then becomes apparent is not only is this like ideological thing going on over here with class society, but when you start from the ground up, you start to see that the market, like Adam Smith is basically right. Like there is a hidden hand of the market. There is a, there is this force, you know, with money right. is not imaginary. Money is incredibly real. It is a socially conditioned force that we all live by. You can't just pretend it doesn't exist. It's an incredibly real thing. And so then this thing starts to emerge that rather than a sort of class division and hierarchy, you start to have this more horizontal leveling in which everything is subjected to this invisible social force, which is money, which is capital. Even the capitalists,
the bodiless body.
Exactly. Even the capitalists, even Elon Musk, even Jeff Bezos are in thrall to capital as a subject. So you have this interesting shift of now suddenly studying capital itself as if it were a self-motivating, self-moving force. And again, this is all kind of a, to go back to that totality, this is one slice. This is one way of starting. You kind of have to bracket out all other ways of talking about it, looking at it, just to fully understand starting from this position, building out from there, what that looks like. And so then Marx's, and we can go more into the technical details, but fetishism is basically this, the word describing this movement of something from the ground, starting from the bottom up, the ground up. And the words themselves are really interesting. Balibar talks about like idol and ideology, idea. You know, these are all the same root words, which is eidos in Greek, which is actually like shape or form or visibility. So it's the same thing as like Plato's forms. It's like, and that kind of gives you a more sense of more of what ideology looks like. It's kind of this, not that it's unreal, right? It's like, it's still kind of this real thing that's being reflected, but it's kind of in this, I think of it like projector almost.
Right. I'm kind of reminded of like it's become a little bit of a joke for us, but this discourse about, oh, it's just a social construct, so it's not real. Oh, that's not real. It's just a social construct. But like, I can't imagine a thing which is real, which has not been socially constructed. Like, what does a social construct mean to you?
Yeah.
What is not a social construct? I mean, maybe a mountain isn't, but like all of the qualities that we ascribe to the mountain, its beauty, its imposition, its, you know, let's say its relative value in mineral wealth, its use as like a tourist destination, whatever kind of mountain and wherever you are, everything about the value and the qualities of that mountain, that's all socially constructed. It's just, I'm continually baffled by this as a discourse.
Yeah.
And the move between that Daniel's describing from the idol to the fetish means that we can no longer see any of this. As soon as the fetish arrives, everything vanishes. So the socially constructed nature of money and exchange value and circulation, etc., becomes the bodiless body, right?
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So yeah. This is that's a great point, because I was going to say the kind of technical use of fetish, of how Marx is talking about it in those opening chapters of Capital, is precisely that the origins are masked. And this is kind of how once the origin is lost or forgotten or masked, you forget there's an origin. I mean, we see this with how nations are made, right? No one remembers that, or they don't want to remember that nations are founded on these, you know, bloody, violent upheavals. It's just like they came into being, and we forget that part. But in a similar way, Marx is saying that the origins, which then in later in Capital, you know, there's that great line of when we finally enter the workshop, and he's like, where no one is allowed no admittance except on business, the secret lair of production where the mysteries are revealed, so to speak. But veiling that, this example David Harvey uses, which I love, is just like when you go to the grocery store, it's not like it's trickery that it's being veiled. It's just, that's how it works. So you go to the grocery store and there's just a bounty of food and you don't ask where it comes from.
Right.
It's just there. And that is the meaning of alienation, that we're, there's so many degrees of separation between that hidden abode of production, how the sausage is actually made, to ending up in our kitchen. And so there's this like great quote about that process, which was the gap between the God and the substitution of what the God stands for and its origins becomes invisible. So there's a gap between what's really going on, pulling back the curtain, and what is apparent. And so that's kind of the difference between the idol and the fetish, is that one is more of kind of this reflection or projection, and one is it's actually real. It's all real life. Like, it's not an illusion. It's a, real, but in a different form. So it's much more, yeah, it's more ghostly. It's more, it's hard to talk about, which is why Marx uses religious imagery and literary imagery. He talks about vampires and, but he talks about, I mean, one of the first descriptions of the commodity, he talks about it as having theological niceties.
Right. Well, you have this great, you quote, you mentioned Dennis Turner when we were first starting, and you have this great quote from him. Earth is given up for heaven. This ideological character of religion leads the believer to relate, in Dennis Turner's words, not to a false world by means of an alternative to the real world, but to the real world in and through the prism of belief in a false world. Religion, in this framing, misconstrues this particular world. So this, like you were saying, this is a total inversion of a mere substitute of the God. It is hard to talk about, though, isn't it?
And yeah,
what you were just saying about the why he uses religious and theological language, I feel like oftentimes getting back to this sort of orthodox secular assumptions about Marxism, I feel like there's a misunderstanding of that famous line about the criticism of religion being the premise of all criticism. There's a total misunderstanding of what that means, as though, oh, we just have to throw this into the dustbin of history. No, Marx is using religious criticism as the first subject, which you say provides him the opportunity to articulate the nature of ideology as a form of consciousness shaped by social and material existence. In other words, by class. So it is actually an integral part of his project, religious criticism, getting back to the whole point of your paper.
Right. Yeah, I had a thought about that.
Anyway, while you're thinking about that, I just feel like a lot of times when those of us who are interested in exercising these muscles with regard to theology and Marxism, they're like, oh, well, you just have some weird attachment, you know, to that religious stuff. And it's really, none of it's necessary. Everything's already there. And yet the there you're talking about, it already contains what we're talking about.
Well,
like, this is in Marx. We're not adding it.
There's often this, you know, the people, they view Christianity in its totalizing role, and they like reject it in favor of its direct opposite, a mirror image of itself. This atheism, or this what they call materialism, their Marxism, I'm putting all that in quotes, in a totalizing role, in this religious reflex of the real world. But in both cases, it's like, I don't think that this means what you think it means, you know?
Right. They're actually engaged in the religious reflex of the real world as atheist Marxists.
Or right.
I'm using that in a very, not derogatory, but surface meaning, like as people who think that religion offers.
For the listener, Ben did air quotes during that whole sentence.
Anyway, we'll get back on track, Daniel. Sorry.
Yeah, these are just this is kind of, it sounds a little triter, like a truism, but it's like similar to your social construct point, Jason, which is like everything in that sense is religious, or you can, like, that is, it's just an inescapable part of how this process works, which is another whole point of fetishism. Like, money isn't just a god as an analogy. Marx is saying it is a god, like full stop, precisely because out of this process of taking two unrelated things and putting them together and saying they equal value, I'm trading a coat for linen and I need money to bind it.
Right.
That right there is the gap where this sort of god comes into being, out of this definition of the origin is hidden, this ghostly third thing comes into being. So it's not like we can just decide not to believe it and it doesn't exist. It just is there. That it's literally the social reality of how this works. And so
It defines all of our relationships, it defines every moment of our being, it defines our future, our past, it defines not just our immediate future, but like the future of our grandchildren. Like that means it is real.
Right.
Now, we don't want it to be. We would like to change it, sure. it has to be contended with as reality. It can't just be whatever. Yeah. It can't just be ignored.
Yeah. And to go back to Balibar, it's this, it's like a more earthly reality. It's not something that is just kind of in this numinous projected sphere, but it's our daily life. It's
right.
conditioning how we actually live and how we may or may not be liberated. And so it ties directly into to kind of go back to the way beginning, but this question of like, is Marx concerned about like, is he in the warm current? Is he in the cold current? And
answer is yes,
whatever. Yeah. He's both. But like, just to be really clear that the ultimate goal of this is justice and liberation. It's and whoever tries to tell you it's not is just like, no, Marx is actually, if you read anything by Marx, you can, it just comes off the page that like the reason we're engaging in this criticism in the first place is to understand it so that it may be changed. And so it might seem really hopeless, or when you talk about totality, it becomes very, you know, there's no escape. And I think it's important to sometimes frame it that way, that, you know, you can't just think your way out of it or change your belief, or it's there, it's reality. But precisely because of that, there's a sort of need to refocus on what it means for human liberation. And so, another piece of this paper is really trying to, I guess, unite that this sort of science, the critical science, with the humanism. And not that humanism as a term and tradition doesn't have its own problems, because it does, but and there's a really important critique of humanism probably can't go into right now, but in any case, and I think that's obviously another part where there's this overlap with liberationist Christianity, which I think would encompass liberation theology, but would include more, because it would include the social practices of a sort of anti-fetishistic Christianity, which is precisely seeing religion and religious spheres as kind of like from the outside, like, and it's not every tradition or practice, but there is a liberationist practice where it is kind of bringing justice to the oppressed and liberating humanity, really, not in some far off coming heaven or other planetary dimension or plane, but right now, right here, that liberation is happening. That's part of what it means to see, you know, religion, Christianity itself, is being anti-fetishistic.
Right. I also think so we have different kinds of theologies. We have liberal theology, we have liberation theology, which poses these tensions within Christianity against one another. It's a critical intervention by Bloch, you know, or even by forgetting his name now. Who's that kind of liberal theologian who talks about the prophetic tradition that we talked about? Anyway, like there's this authoritarian theocratic monarchical tradition, and then there's the liberatory, dispossessed version embodied by Jesus himself. And I feel like that can be really flattened into just like a moral choice. Whereas the introduction of the fetishistic factor makes it much more dynamic and something that is insinuated into the very ground of everything, right? It is a part of a, you know, when Marx says that the criticism of religion is the premise of all criticism, he's aiming at capital, you know? He might be aiming through religion and ideology, but the target is on capital's head. And this reification that, there's another section I found. Marx, you say on page 4 that Marx's point with his line of the cultist, that Christianity with its cultus of abstract man is the most fitting religious expression for capitalism. You say Marx's point is that Christianity in its practices and discourses has become bound up with the all-encompassing religious logic of capitalism itself. and that logic's irresistible extension into the realm of the symbolic, thus fetishized Christianity, which is more pointed than saying theocratic or authoritarian or monarchical, right. Is shaped by and plays an active role in the process of reification, the making into a thing of human beings as a mundane extension of capitalism's operation. So this is so much more profound than just choosing the liberatory.
Right. Yeah. And it's, and again, on that word reification, I know a lot of Marxists want to read that as a, it's more of a technical thing. He's not talking about, humans per se, but about some other, and I just want to say like, no, I think it is. and that's, I think technically that's more of a Weberian insight. So there's, and to go back to Bloch, there is this tradition of a kind of Marxist Weber synthesis, because Weber has this concept of capitalism as an iron cage, shackling human power, and to that I just kind of want to say like, I don't care really about the distinctions. I think it's to me that's really the point though, is the making into a thing is kind of describing how this process alienates us from one another. And fetishistic Christianity, to go back to that technical definition, is the kind of Christianity that wants to mask the origins and make a static thing out of this faith, rather than seeing the real liberatory actions and potential of what it means to transform the current world, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. That's the message of Jesus that the early Christians believed, was that there is a coming transformation of the world now, not when we die and go to heaven. That's later. That's a later addition. That's, you know, all the evidence. The historical Jesus is one of my favorite, just like historical scholarship things. And I just read this book. I talked to Ben a lot about it. E.P. Sanders, The Historical Figure of Jesus. It's really great. If you're interested in that, but that all the evidence points to Jesus himself was this, you know, Jewish prophet who expected the immediate transformation. The world as we know it now, you know, next week, it's going to be different. Like, you're not going to recognize it. It's not going to be destroyed, or, you know, it's not apocalyptic in that sense. It's apocalyptic in unveiling the true nature. And what's even wilder is that the way that the disciples and the early Christians heard that is that not only is it about to come, but we're actually participating in it right now. Like,
right.
The powers that we have, that's the powers of that world here right now, by laying on of hands, by what we're doing. And so, like,
I mean, that's what is meant by the kingdom of God is within you. It's like, it's not a metaphor. It's like, it's actually the case.
Exactly.
And, you know, you don't have to think too hard about how that sounds exactly like socialism, like that.
Right.
Those two things are actually describing the same utopian impulse toward this transformed world in the here and now, right now. There's no way we could summarize it, but to go back to that question of utopia you had about Bloch, I mean, that's what we're talking about here. So that's again,
some of the things that have not been interrogated enough, strangely enough, even by Marxists, is the nature of the third thing, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot about this conversation that we had with Ben back before, like, I think like 2 years before Ben actually joined the podcast. The episode was called Marxist Christian Dialogue, something like that. And it was, I was trying to set forth this kind of charge. I was making this charge. So I'm setting forth the task, at least for myself. But I feel like it's something that we should all take up, which is that, like, to be able to conceptualize, you know, let's say the revolution as a thing, as an event, as a series, as an epoch, which is made by people who are not the revolutionaries, people who are not Marxists or not communists, they don't have an understanding of political economy that matches up with yours, whatever. That's who's going to make the revolution. And similarly, the people who are going to usher in the kingdom of God to build the city on the hill aren't necessarily conscious of that as a task. So the revolution and the bringing about of the apocalypse, that's the same moment. And until that, those two understandings of our life, of of human totality, until those two understandings are merged together, they're not possible. At least that's what I think. Neither one is possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you're describing is like part and parcel of this deep ground level alienation from one to all.
Well, yeah. And we have already seen like the whole last century is marked by precisely the one and not the other. Like, I mean, I have lots to say about the fact that the USSR doesn't exist anymore, but at least a big part of it, despite the fact that huge numbers of people in the former USSR are nostalgic for their childhoods because of the relative security and whatever that society provided, they're not communists, and they might be Orthodox, especially now they're Orthodox Christians, and they're nostalgic for the USSR. So how do you even account for that? It's because one half of what humanity needs was starting to be present, but not the other half. That's all. I mean, to be simplistic about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that's also, maybe this is starting a new thought, but just I'll say quickly that I think that's part of what the end of this paper is trying to do as well with, there's a lot of steps to get there, but basically I talk about utopia as well as the opposite of the idea of the fetish is masking origins and creating this kind of right. I'm reminded of, there's this kind of within the last 20 years, you know, there've been like a lot of these newer translations of Marx into English. Like the Grundrisse is older, but there's supposed to be a new version of Capital coming out later this year, I think. But like one of the things that was like, you know, miscommunicated in the old version, the Penguin edition, which is like the character mask. So that's another piece of the fetish argument, which is that Marx talks about how like actors go around and they wear the character mask of.
Right.
That's another way of describing the veiling of the real world that's happening with the fetish is we inhabit these roles, but that there's this veil between people, that veil is alienation. And so to think through that on the way to utopia, there's some really interesting things you can think about with, or at least that I bring up with utopia as this, as real presence, as transparency. And what does that even mean? You know, it can mean so many different things, but we talk about like, is it possible to imagine new futures? And one of the places this gets done so well is science fiction. And I don't think we've mentioned Frederick Jameson yet, but amazing writer. But he has a whole book on science fiction, Archaeologies of the Future. And that's one of the first places I would look to for examples of utopian ideas of societies where this veil of alienation doesn't exist. And I think of like Kim Stanley Robinson, the Mars trilogy is really interesting. Ursula K. Le Guin, Dispossessed, The Left Hand of Darkness. Mm-hmm. These books are all great. But what they do is they show like what is Marx's line? Something about like human history doesn't truly begin until, you know, the free associated producer is in direct relationship with production and with other free producers, which is another way of saying that the veil has been removed. There's transparency in our social relations that only then can human history actually start. Some of these books are actually really brilliant and moving ways of thinking that thought through of the Mars trilogy is like kind of what is human possibility and potential when we actually get to live history.
Right.
It doesn't solve any of the problems in terms of our whatever human nature is, but it definitely changes the rules of the game, right?
It also presumes that human nature has not yet been allowed to begin, in truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is going to get us into apophaticism, right? Which is a big dynamic move you're making. Before we do that, Can we just kind of ground the shift that is being made, that Balabar is saying is made between the idol and the fetish? Because I feel like we acknowledged it, you know, in a loose conceptual way. But like, so Marx is the bridge. He's taking Fjorbark, who you've been reading recently, Daniel.
And yeah. Side note that, you know, the Marx's theses on Feuerbach are great, but Feuerbach is also great. I think some of Marx's criticisms of him actually might not be totally right. But anyway.
It happens to be the case that some of Marx's criticisms of lots of things aren't exactly right.
Yeah.
Like, if the only thing you'll know of Hegel is what Marx had to say about Hegel, and even that would be better than what most people know, which is that they know what other people say about what Marx had to say about Hegel.
Right.
And they say, oh, yeah, I know Hegel because of this guy I know wrote a book about Marx who wrote a commentary on one book by Hegel. It's like,
yeah.
There's so much more than just the criticisms, even if they're all valid, which they're not. But even if they are, you should still read, like, you know, like you just said, like Feuerbach. It's like there's more to it than that. Mm-hmm.
So what is the move? If you can like just kind of cleanly state between the idol and the fetish, we've kind of explained it in more or less obtuse ways, but like, what is the essential change?
I was prepared for this question. And I think I have a great soundbite, which is, I think I would describe it as, we make the idol, but the fetish makes us.
Ah.
Oh, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's the soundbite. And then Balabar further describes it as what I think is also a useful distinction between dominance and subjection. So dominance is of the idol and ideology where, you know, one class is ruling and kind of dominating another class. Subjection is, and again, there's no subject other than capital itself, which is this paradox, but that out of the organic reality of the social forces that is the market, there arises this body without a body, this third thing, this grotesque, ghostly presence that is money, and that it's like the sun. We're all just, you can't hide from it. We're all subjected to it. It's a law. It really is. And you could protest, you can try not to, but at the end of the day, you got to have a retirement account and you got to watch that little line go up. Like we have to, we just have to and so starting from that, that's the shift. That's the move. So then I kind of take it back to Marx and like going really closely through those chapters on commodities and really, so then with that understanding, trying to read it basically as a theological critique, right? It's not an economic textbook. It's not even history. It's history. That's the last part of Capital. That's like the last chapter,
right?
Is when you finally turn to chronological history. Right now it's more philosophical, or I would even say theological. And what he's describing is how out of that atom, which is the commodity, which is real, it's a thing you can touch, it's real. But this process of exchange, and the way I think of it is really like this, if the idol and ideology was a vertical relationship, this is a horizontal relationship and really broad, like infinitely extended outward, right? That's when Marx talks about how commodities are exchanged. I work in web development, so I'm just thought of like a database analogy, but it's like many to many relationship. It's not like pick any node in the system and that node can be infinitely related to all the other nodes, right? It's never simply one way and back. It's all directions always.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Is this what Balabar calls the strict reciprocity?
Yeah. But then that strict reciprocity is sort of, it extends again from any point, that you choose to focus on, right? You can never sort of isolate it into a, well, yeah, anyway.
Well, but, you define it, quoting Balibar, a strict reciprocity as, in the market, each individual presents himself to the other as the bearer of the universal, i.e.
right.
of purchasing power as such. And this yeah. becomes really complicated because this is what, this is the source of bourgeois universal rights, you know, at the very same time.
So there's a jump that happens, and I should try to describe the jump, because the argument that Marx makes is that, so yeah, you, if you have that image of the nodes, or the horizontal network of all these nodes, pretty soon what happens is that you have this universalizer that has, that sort of has to rise above all of that to make sense of why is A related to B and C and D, and B is related to the same and more, right? And that's his argument for how money works, is that it sort of rises as this umbrella above everything, because it's the universally connective glue that relates everything to one another. And the characteristics of it are that it's universal, it's equalizing, it's essentializing, right? It's like not by anyone's choice, or it's just like, it's just doing it. It's sitting there doing it. And so then the move that I want to try to make with Balibar and some other people is that, so not only is that happening, but then that, because it's kind of like sociologically constructing our behavior, right? We go to the market, so to speak. We engage in these behaviors. It has a real power over us. This is a truth of religion. If you go to worship, your actions, your body is formed by what you worship. And so we start to take that on. That becomes a thing that passes over into this realm of Marx's really astounding but thought-provoking argument, which is that the reason we have this concept of everyone is free and equal under the law is because we know that because of commodity exchange.
Yeah.
Like that's where we got that idea, not from the inherent dignity of a person, but.
Because like what else would even be the basis?
Right.
I mean, I don't mean like what might you imagine to be the basis. I mean, historically, what has thus far been the basis? And it would only be exactly. to facilitate exchange. And that's it.
Right. And so this is where I think something I wanted to mention earlier, but never got a chance around to it. But this was kind of another prong of what I wanted to define myself against or sort of try to figure out, was just frustration with how a lot of specifically left liberal progressive Christians tend to talk about basically idolatry or like money. And to think about it in that sense that we've been talking as like idol and idolatry, but that it's basically something you could just decide
right
to rebel against.
And you could disavow, yeah, but we're talking about something that is undisavowable.
Right,
right. Like the what you're I was gonna say tilting at. That's the wrong one. That sounds negative. What you're referring to is like an attitude about a thing that is. You're making too much of it. It's important, sure, but it's not. Don't make it an idol. It's like take it and put it over here. And what you're saying is, like, the entire way that we approach and appreciate this phenomenon needs to be exchanged. Not just. It's not a matter of turning it down a little bit from like 10 to 5. You know, it's right. an entirely different understanding of really all of social reality.
Mm-hmm. Right, because it is in fact turning us down or up, yeah. And we don't have control of the volume.
Like, yeah.
Well, the analogy I would use is very related to the fetish, which is, I don't think I had mentioned this yet before, but the German word is actually incredible. It's Machwerk, which is like a handmade thing. Like it's a thing made from the earth, but then that takes on a life of its own. It controls us. That's the connotative meaning, but it's a golden calf, right? It's a thing that we make from the materials of the earth. It's materialist, but then it arises out of its, in quotes, out of its own free will. It's right. not totally accurate, but, and so the only possible response to that is to break the idol, to smash it with a hammer, right. Which is what the Bible has these stories happening. not in the exact same way. I think it'd be wrong to say that's what Moses was thinking, but when he smashed the golden calf, but that
yeah, might but not it wasn't, even have been what it Jesus was not what he was thinking.
Right. But it, the point is
not, it's maybe, let's say it's not possible to say that's what he was thinking, but it's not helpful to say that's not what he was thinking either.
Yeah. Right. Naomi Klein, at her street Seder speech invoked Zionism as idolatry. This is an aside, but in a really beautiful way. Anyway, on page 12, Daniel, this is maybe why I was wanting to just kind of mull in this a bit more with regard to idol versus fetish and Feuerbach. I'm just going to read a passage you wrote that says what we've been saying, but maybe in a clear way. Christianity takes on this privileged role in capitalism because of its fetishization of a universal equivalent, namely that of an abstract, reified human essence, and by Feuerbachian inversion, an equally abstract divine essence. This essentialized human nature is likened to, but also informed by, the universal equivalent of value, which seems to inhere in commodities. Hence, fetishized Christianity does not just enable the dominance of ruling classes, it in fact replicates capitalism's logic of exchange and laws of motion in its symbolic forms. So I feel like this is just sussing out all of the interrogative meaning in Marx's statement on the premise, religious criticism being the premise of all criticism. And I know that I just wanted to address all of that like pointedly, but I know that apophaticism is something we should really dwell on. Do you want to kind of just, you've sort of defined, can you, you want to kind of just definitively define that for us in contrast
That's
to
not a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. Before I do that, can I just have a comment on what you just read, though, too?
Yes. Yes.
In case we don't come back to it, which is thank you for reading that part, though, because that that's kind of the link into one of the because this paper is an essay. It's just trying, right? It's trying out all these different things, and one of the things it's trying out is what you just read, which is moving. That idea of universal equivalent, this like leveling, essentializing abstraction of money and value, then where else does that show up in basically how we, not only in how we think, but in how we act? And what I wanted to try to do was, through the help of decolonial thought and liberation theology, is to try to understand how that jumps into theological and philosophical frameworks that were the justification for colonialism and for capitalism in its really early stages as, you know, basically harnessing the labor power of the rest of the world for European wealth, which is something a lot of, including Marx, was one of the first to write about. I wanted to share what it means is that Christianity becomes about the saving of abstract souls for an imagined heaven rather than a tool of liberation. And I have this part in the paper on like Christopher Columbus, who actually wrote and had, you know, some like very insightful in a bad way, like revealing of, he talks about like the world being made, for humans. And this is like one of the more negative senses of humanism. By what he means by that is a human essence that is European and colonialist, and
right.
So that literally enables the, you know, he was going to the Americas to
humanize them. He was going to humanize them with his Rottweilers.
Yeah, but it's a really instructive example because it's, you know, it's maybe a link we don't make as often as we should, but that those exploits into the colonization of the Americas and elsewhere, we're generating wealth for Europe to become the birth of capitalism, right? These things are all linked. This is something an insight that decolonial thought really and critique really makes evident that link between, you know, what is the bloody necessity at the beginning of capitalism? What enables this whole thing to start? So anyway, I just wanted to dwell on that for a second.
Totally.
Yes, for apophatic.
And this is also bringing us into contact with what Jose Porfirio Miranda terms authentic Christianity, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, the apophatic. So this was one of the other sort of things I wanted to try out, which is the apophatic is something I know from my studies of Christianity, and the really, really basic definition of it is that it's coming at our talk, our theology, or our talk of God, or our union with God from a negative, by making negative statements rather than positive statements. And an example, really based, simple example of that would be a positive statement is God is all loving or all knowing. And a negative statement would be God is unlimited or beyond all categories of what we can think. And so it kind of serves this purpose to radically, to make that gap of transcendence really great. But the tradition of it ends up being, it goes all the way back to like the sixth century, I think is the first, is when Pseudo-Dionysius is got my great classics of Western spirituality. This is like a sixth century writer, and there's a lot of tensions and interesting things, but I wanted to read like a little passage because I think it kind of describes better what is apophatic theology. So he writes that God is present to all and he is everywhere according to one and the same and the totality of everything. He proceeds to everything while yet remaining within himself. He is at rest and astir, is neither resting nor stirring, and has neither source nor middle nor end. He is in nothing. He is no thing. The categories of eternity and of time do not apply to him, since he transcends both and transcends whatever lies within them. Eternity itself and beings and the measure of beings and the measured world exist through him and from him. So, and as you can probably imagine, this is completely attached to like a very mystical sense of knowing or unknowing God. And so, and so my initial thought was that, you know, I've been really interested in that for a while, and, but it's eerily similar to the dialectic of a negation of a negation. The authors of within this tradition will literally use those words. St. John of the Cross is another medieval writer. And so I thought, there's my link, you know, Marxist criticism is not just a protest. It's not just a reaction against a thing. It then moves through that into another capitulation or formulation of something new. In the same way, this apophatic from within Christianity's own tradition offers a similar way of thinking about God and theology and what comes from that. And my really like simplified soundbite on that is kind of like, it's just really close to atheism. I mean, that's what I've always thought. It's like, again, that idea of like bracketing, like, let's just be atheists for a little while and see how far we can go, knowing that that's a tool to get sort of to the other side, as it were, to, So there's a lot there for sure.
Right. An atheism that is in tension with a theism continuously, like not the kind where you're like, that's all dust bin material, you know, it's something that's dynamic.
Right. It's not just another reflex of the real world of what is in this static way, this kind of like objective reality. It's like it either is or is not this thing. So the religious person says this, and the atheist person says this, and these are the two ways to understand the one thing. And I just reject that. And it's very common. It's a kind of common like meme right now of like, reject this and also that, embrace a secret third thing. And it's like, I love the fact that all of you are like right on the precipice of understanding what it means to sublate, to negate the negation. Like there's like a beginner's dialectics, which is like being discussed and understood all around without any appreciation for like, I mean, forget Marx or forget Hegel, but like Hermes Trismegistus or Jesus Christ. You know, it's like no matter where you look, it's there. If you would only look a little bit harder.
Right.
Well, yeah. And the, I mean, the analogy of sight, though, is actually perfectly spot on. Incidentally, that's also the word theory. Theoria comes from seeing. Just another interesting tidbit. But here's another passage from Pseudo Dionysius, or some people also call him Pseudo Dennis. The same spelling as Dennis Turner, which I actually like better.
Pseudo Dennis. Pseudo Dennis the Menace.
Basically, yeah, there's this guy could be one of five different people or woman, you know, like who knows, pseudonymous author, but we'll call him Pseudo Dennis. this is just another way I think of talking about that idea of that the only way is through, and only at the most negative of the negation is the chance of seeing again possible. So the passage is, I pray that we could come to this darkness so far above light. If only we lacked sight, as if only we lacked sight and knowledge so as to see, so as to know, unseeing and unknowing, which lies beyond all vision and knowledge. For this would be really to see and to know, to praise the transcendent one in a transcending way, namely through the denial of all beings. We would be like sculptors who set out to carve a statue. They remove every obstacle to the pure view of the hidden image, and simply by this act of clearing aside, they show up the beauty which is hidden.
It really is so, actually kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's very, yeah, it's poetry. I mean, it's,
and again, it's he's talking about unmasking.
Right.
Right.
And so I'll say that. And then this is a little incidental, but just to say that the, so in the paper I deal with Marika Rose, who's this great author who writes a whole book on apophatic theology and talks a lot about this. But she draws out that this is this tradition. It's not just a simple solution. Like you might think you're innocent of just like using the apophatic and then have done with it, but it's really complicated. And I don't know if this is more of the current literature that I was saying that I was a little out of my depth in, but I would summarize it by saying there's a tension in these medieval works, as might be expected. There's still this, it's a tension between this kind of, if you're familiar with like the great chain of being, of like this hierarchy of, was this like very Platonic medieval Christian way of talking about like creation, and that God is at the head, and then there's these gradations of being all the way down, which, you know, is inherently hierarchical. And then all of a sudden you're dealing with this tension of there's an implicit hierarchy in the universe, which means there's some things at the top. The church is definitely at the top. And but it's again, it's a question of starting. It's like, do you start from the top or do you start from the bottom? And starting from the bottom leads you to some really interesting things. And it's not for nothing that Thomas Munzer was a mystic, you know, like,
right.
So when you start from the bottom, you come to very different conclusions as when you start from the top.
Yeah, it's like, that's why Meister Eckhart or like Marguerite Poret or like all of the, what are they called? The French sect of...
the worker priests? Mystic. Oh.
No. They're like all female. Doesn't really matter. There was a very long period for a while, pre-Reformation, lots and lots of theologians and mystics and, you know, people with official positions in the church were all kind of coming to similar kind of very out there positions. And some of them were persecuted and denounced as heretics. And some of them weren't, like Meister Eckhart. Meister Eckhart was more like just kind of ignored or like slowly kind of quietly just put aside. But this has all just been at the core of understanding what is and what is to be ever since well before Christianity, really. Yeah. But definitely since Christianity, for sure.
I was thinking earlier, when we were talking about atheism in tension with theism.
The Beguines.
Oh, the Beguines.
That's what I was trying to think of. Mm. Yeah. The Beguine. Sorry.
Hey, Beguine. That gives new meaning to Begin the Beguine.
Yeah, it really does. And it's also a good song.
I was thinking of the, you quote Enrique Dussel later, and he does a, he's a liberation theologian. I think he passed away the past few years, right?
Yeah, I think it was last year.
Writing in, is he in, what country is he in, Mexico? Or
yeah, he was, I think he was born in Argentina, but associated with Mexico.
He you quote him, and this is just, I think, well, it definitely it has resonance with Bloch, the other thing I quoted earlier. He says, atheism vis-a-vis the fetish is the negative precondition for revolution. Affirmation of absolute exteriority is the affirmative and definitive precondition for liberation. Both preconditions are practical. It is an action that the fetish is denied and exteriority affirmed when one assumes responsibility for the oppressed. And all what was St. Francis doing, right? What were all these other examples you brought up, the two of you brought up doing? So I just found that like super, just opening up so much.
Yeah.
I wanted to also read, if you don't mind, Daniel, when you first introduce apophaticism, I just feel like it's really lucid and useful. Mm-hmm. This is on page 5. Apophaticism denies any positive essence of the divine and human, and thus moves beyond affirmation and negation into a negation of the negation, a dialectical advancement to a new plane, which both transcends and abolishes its previous dualism. In terms of fetishism, the apophatic stress on absence in relation to the thing which stands in place of a god challenges the fetish's false divinity and restores the perception of reified human beings who exist behind the fetish. Apophatic absence, the radical denial of structural symbolic divinity in capitalism, is thus the basis for transcending the false presence of the fetish and reconstituting the real presence of transparent social relations among people. So I know you'd already kind of laid that out, but I just found that really valuable. And actually finding some resonance with some of our previous conversations around what we here frame as dialectical pessimism, removing the mask, it's about transcending the false presence is about reconstituting the real presence.
Yeah.
Did I tell you how I met Daniel, Jason?
No, so you did not.
It's through Magnificast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I joined their Discord a while ago, and we were on, what were we reading? We were reading Guy Debord. We were reading Society of the Spectacle, like four of us,
right,
in one of the breakout channels.
That's awesome.
And we all just sort of like saying, oh, we're here. You mentioned you were in LA, and I was like, you're in LA? You were like, yeah. I'm actually in Pasadena. I was like, what? So then we just had this running intention to get coffee for kind of a while.
Yeah.
And then maybe
I got to say, I was a little nervous about meeting someone from the internet.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad I did.
I think you might be my first person that I've done that with. Anyway,
well, we're a testament to how great it worked out.
It turns out that like Daniel's like our northern equivalent. Evangelicalism in Illinois
is
slightly different from the southern version, but
I wonder if it's like, did it migrate over directly from the Burnover district, or was it like circuitous and it ends up in Illinois? And that's not really a question, it's just something I'm going to wonder about.
Is it, what's the denomination you came from again? Is it Congregationalist?
I was in a denomination called Evangelical Congregational, and it's pretty small, but and a kind of interesting mix of basically Wesleyan, like revivalist, that whole, like early Americas, that whole thing. And
yeah, so actually,
like Billy Graham.
It's a direct, the drift from the Hudson Valley directly over to Illinois.
Yeah. So yeah, I like, at some point when I was in college, I went to a Christian college, and there was a lot of Calvinists there, Calvinist evangelicals. And I was like, I didn't know what they were. I was like, what? And then I realized that like the evangelicalism I was brought up with was like very, very free will. Like radically opposite of Calvinism, to the point that I heard sermons on how one sermon, it's possible to achieve perfection from sin.
I mean, that's like a foundational premise of at least a certain kind of a congregationalist theology. Yeah.
That is not what I grew up with.
The flip side is that it's possible to lose it in an instant. So try giving that anxiety to a child. Just like you're never sure of your salvation.
Yeah. I think that I like what Meister Eckhart teaches, which is like we have to strive. One must strive at all times to achieve that perfection from sin, despite the fact that you're not likely to ever get there. And if you're trying to get there, you're definitely not going to go the opposite route by divorcing yourself from knowing. That's the best way to know God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was just talking to my mom about that, 'cause she's just in this ongoing continuous deconstruction of her faith. She was closer to the fire, you know, being the daughter of the evangelist. Yeah. So she's like, I mean, she's a straight up heretic now, but she's just like retained relationships with people who are still in the church. And she's like, if they knew this, they would, you know, they freaked out. But she's anyway, we were just agreeing that like, as soon as you like nail down that, you know, what God is, which we could say fetishize, right?
Right.
You lose him, you know, right. By doing that, you actually lose him. So
exactly. Yeah.
That's what it means to say, be still and know that I am God. Mm. It's not like, again, it's not a metaphor. It's just, it's not knowing is what is the basis of understanding, not knowing, like, not in a logical sense, but in an emotive sense. You get it now, and you know in a way that's distinct from intellectually knowing.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Which is almost untranslatable to...
I mean, it is untranslatable to...
I mean, it is, but it's... Well, you just said it, and I think we both understood it. But if we were to try and...
I think the only reason why you both understand it is because you're trying to, and your basis of trying to predates my saying it. Like if I went to a good friend of mine, let's imagine I have a friend who's from Los Angeles, who was not raised religious. And, you know, this friend is like very materialist and very, very steeped in a certain understanding of what it means to be scientific in your thinking. What I just said sounds like total gibberish.
That's what I'm saying.
What is knowing that is not knowing? It's like, it's a set of words. It's a set of terms that you have too limited understanding to even appreciate that knowing is not an intellectual exercise. Knowing is not a thing that you can achieve and move on from. Well, to put it in Hegelian terms, actually to put it in Hegel's phrase even, absolute knowing is a permanent agenda.
Hmm.
You don't just arrive at absolute knowing and now you're done.
Right.
Because once you get there, that's the point at which, well, to be like Ernst Bloch, that's when you say, well, now what?
Yeah.
How do we start again? How do we circumlocute this truth and arrive and look at it from another perspective and gain a greater appreciation for it?
Right.
That's what it means to know. That's what it means to actually, the precise terms even escape me. But that is the point of coming to know God. As a concept, it's not you don't know God like this is God. Now I know God and I have God with me. It's like, that's the surest way to be as far away from knowing God as possible.
Right. That's why I always say when being around certain kinds of religious people is what activates my atheism, you know, mm-hmm. And there's a kind of way in which even before I read any of the kind of stuff we're talking about, I was like, oh, these two things. Not necessarily like a devil and an angel on the shoulders, but these two things are operable in a kind of fluxus way.
It's almost as though you've rejected one and also the other. Now you've embraced a secret third thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think about like the understanding of Christianity that was raised with in the Assemblies of God denomination. And there's no wonder I spent a good decade as an atheist, because if that's Christianity and that's all there is, so there's these two things, yeah, I'm an atheist, sure. Because I'm definitely not whatever that is.
Right.
But I'm also not an atheist. I'm a secret third thing.
You're a third campist. The Lord. Yeah, exactly.
And it's actually, it's the experience of my atheism that has allowed me to, I don't want to say return, because that's the wrong way to think about it. It's like this, you know, I have a loop, but it's not just, the loop spiral. Is not static.
Spiral.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's spiraling upward.
Listeners, hey, Jason is doing his finger in the air in a spiral once again.
And like going off the camera. Like I'm not just like swirling around. I'm swirling around and also raising my arm until it goes off screen.
Yeah.
And that's the dialectic.
Yeah. Also what you just said, I was thinking of experience is the only way of knowing that. It's not an intellectual
grasping.
And that's the truth of apophatic theology and mysticism too, which is honestly something I didn't understand I was drawn to it intellectually a long time ago, but it made me uncomfortable because I didn't have the actual experience of it. And I feel like I do more now. You actually have to go through the dark night of the soul, is the metaphor. And it sounds bad.
It's
and scary.
Metaphorical, but it's also real.
Yeah.
But it makes it sound gloomy and I mean, it's not
it kind
that.
Of is. Well, it can be.
It can be.
Right.
It can be a losing. It can be grief. It can be a lot of emotional things. But the actual, the sort of mechanism of it is just what you were describing. That constant, the refusal to let the static be the thing, to just keep going around the spiral.
Yeah,
and that's what I've.
And it happens to be applicable in all things, like Marxism. Ceases to be a living, breathing corpus of, like, it ceases to be a way of understanding things at a certain point. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, Soviet political thinkers from, like, 1960 onward. Can't think of a single one.
They were all dissidents.
Well, yeah, exactly. Same thing you could extrapolate that in every direction. The minute you have arrived at, this is the thing, and this is true, and the way it is right now is the way it's going to be, and that's the way everything is. That's the end of that thing.
Mm. Yeah. It turns out doubt is an essential part of faith.
Right.
It might be worthwhile just to – maybe we can button it all up. I don't know. But we haven't quite really interrogated the so we know that the apophatic lends itself to – negating the false reality and reconstituting a present reality that is real, but there's also this Christian ambiguity paired with Marxist criticism that maybe bears some fleshing out, because it's not exactly like, oh well, we just take a little of this palette and a little of this palette and then we make a new color kind of thing, you know.
Right.
This is beside the point, but I highlighted and underlined bad infinity.
Yeah. Highlighted and underlined. That's how you know it's serious.
Yeah, yeah. Which is
you
to say
the bad infinity.
It's the masked infinity, the infinity that is the madness that keeps us from salvation.
I don't know if this is exactly where you're thinking, but I did want to say something about, to go back to Marika Rose slightly, and this is the book, A Theology of Failure, Zizek Against Christian Innocence. So it's a lot of Zizek in it, which might be a turnoff, but...
Not for Jason. Jason's a partisan for Zizek.
It's funny because I like Zizek, but I also really, really don't. Like, I really dislike what he has to say in terms of, like, political commentary in the last couple of years, but I have gained an entirely new appreciation for what he has to say philosophically for all of time.
I feel like I like him and approach him as like a good person to have as a tool against your enemies or against as a critic, but you don't necessarily want him on your team.
Right.
You don't want him to show up at Thanksgiving.
I don't know.
That's actually a really good way to put it.
Depends on what kind of uncle you have, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this book is great if you're interested in apophatic theology, because she goes through all of the details about it and then brings it up to like a lot of the so apophatic, I should say, that whole concept got taken up by like deconstructionist continental philosophy. So she does a really good job at contextualizing that and showing why it's, you know, it's not just like an innocent term. There's a lot bound up with it. And then brings in a lot of like Lacan with Zizek. But the point that I found interesting for this paper was like, she talks about this Lacanian distinction between desire and drive. And I'm not sure I could give a technical explanation, but the way I think about it is like, drive is this kind of like linear, always striving to, going back to that essentialist idea, like to like envelop or subsume the object of desire. And it's very, you know, dominating, controlling. Whereas drive is this like, instead of a linear trajectory, it's a circular path, going back to earlier, but it's described as like gratification in the act of never attaining the object of desire. So the fact that it's actually the continual circling around it, the failure to achieve unity with it, is the point.
The desire of desire.
Yeah. Yeah. And she does something really brilliant with that, with maybe to center it around just like this question of Christianity and theology. So her, like one of her main themes is like failure. And so what does it mean to, you know, how do you continue to be a Christian, basically? What does that mean? How do you take up those tools and use it? And that framework is being really helpful in fitting into this world of again, rejecting that essentialist, that idea of wanting to bring the whole world into this thing, right? Try to save a salvation for all people. And this like really, what it appears is like this bringing all people into the fold, but masks this, you know, this sort of other thing going behind the curtain and the suppression, shifting from that to this idea of it is a failure and it will be a failure, but that the failure is still worthwhile.
Yeah.
Precisely because it's a failure. And going back again to Block, I think Block talks a little bit about it, but even just to, Jesus, because then Marika Rose does something. So she's like, her phrase is like, it's basically faithfulness to Christ is what it comes down to. And what that actually means is faithfulness to that promise of transformation of the world. But this idea of failure is like wrapping that. I think Ben and I have talked about this, but even thinking of the crucifixion is a failure. It's not the theology I was brought up with was like, this is the pinnacle of the atonement, of how our human nature is fundamentally flawed and we need the savior to fix it. But what if actually the cross is the complete failure of this, the real movement of Jesus and his followers to expect the coming transformation of the world and to try to bring it about. Jesus is basically wrong. What does that say about, there's passages where he says, there are some of you here now who will see the coming the coming new world. And, you know, later we interpret that as he's talking about heaven or something. But what if he actually meant, no, you guys will be there. It's going to happen on Wednesday at 4 o'clock. Like, you'll be there. I know.
Well, in a certain sense, like when the Acts of the Apostles, there's a way of interpreting a lot of those passages as being actually living in the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
By the way that the believers constructed their own communities. Like, that is the kingdom of God.
Right.
They held everything in common and so on and so on, right?
Exactly, yeah. And I would see
there's,
even
there's a lot of different ways you can read this stuff, but
yeah.
The idea of Jesus being wrong is a shouldn't be thought of as heretical as I think it is, because it's a way to start thinking again, really.
Yeah. Right. But the failure wasn't writ throughout. We're looking at it, you know, this is past tense, and mm-hmm. we know what happens.
Right.
Just like with the Bolshevik Revolution, like, it wasn't written that it would fall like dominoes into fucking high Stalinism. Like, it only became a failure when it did. It wasn't the ministry of Jesus was not a failure. And we have these testaments, which do bear interpretation and criticism, but they're intact, I mean, more or less. This part, I'm looking now, you say, for the problems of economy and apophaticism is that rather than starting from a perfect whole and seeking an always unrealizable reunion with that whole, the starting point itself is always an already ruptured and failed site of being. And if anything, that's a truth that comes through in the reading of the gospel. I mean, they've tried to mask it. You say this starting point does not seek to undo the paradox of the relative and universal, or of the antagonism between negativity and positivity, but focuses instead on the transformation of the particular from within. Transcendence and immanence are not opposed as antagonists, but are transposed to a material realm where they play dialectically against a ground which is by nature in flux and always coming into being. Now that's some big moves there.
Yeah. what page is that?
That is 18. But I think that pretty concisely frames a lot of what we're grasping for sometimes.
Yeah.
And even though that was very lucid and clear, now when I'm trying to process it, it's like when I'm trying to process it in a, say, praxis-oriented way, suddenly I'm just, my horizon is full of sunspots.
I mean, I also want to think, part of me always wants to think, you know, what's the practical application, right? What's the praxis? Which is a Christian thing too, right? In youth group, it's like, how do I go be a better Christian? And it's hard to put into words. I mean, this has always been, again, a Marxist thing. It's like, it's easier to critique the wrong thing, like the critique of the Gotha program. It's like someone puts forth the program for communism, and it's way easier to say what's wrong about it than to give a positive statement of what it could be, and that's just the nature of it. But
yeah,
something that jumped out at me from what you're reading is that idea of a couple things. One is like the starting from the already ruptured site. I think that, again, it's just like to be in a stance of humility, whether it's on the religious or the Marxist side. And it's, I think that's a useful corrective to the kind of progressive, everything is always linearly marching up, onward and upward. Right. That's problematic for a lot of different reasons, but, I think the more vocal we can be about, that led to a lot of really bad things on the capitalist side, on the Christian side.
Yeah.
these histories of oppression and destruction, and that there's never, I don't know, there's never going to be a way to just try again the same thing.
Right.
Those things, like, we only ever start from the trash heap of where we are currently.
Oh, man, are we in a trash heap or what?
Yeah.
I mean, what I just read from you and what you just said is reminding me of how John Greenaway closed out our talk with him last time, quoting Mark Fisher. And I can only paraphrase, yeah. But when all possibilities or avenues are foreclosed, it is only then that anything is truly possible. Yeah. And that's like this very, that's different than, say, the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice, which does have a utopian dimension, but there's a linear dimension which is at odds with the kind of emotive hope that's trying to maintain, right?
Yeah. Hey, you know, I was just thinking, I just thought of this. It's going to be 5 o'clock for me pretty soon.
Okay.
So I might need to go quicker than I thought I needed to. So, yeah, I don't know.
No, I'm done. I'm ready to wrap up too.
It's probably a good idea.
We've
rung the rag. So we should leave space for final thoughts for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, before a final thought, I was just going to say,
a pre-final
on Ben's point. one thing I just wanted to say was I still think getting people together is radical. Like, that's another in the theme of the paper too, of like, like how this plays out. It, like, alienation is isolation from other people. Right. And you can do this whole thing on, you know, how neoliberalism is, that's part of the, how neoliberal policies have been weaponized to, you know, like, divide workers, have them compete against themselves, to sort of isolate us in these little pods. I think more than ever, even as we see with campus protests and lots of other different things, like, just getting bodies together is actually radical, and people don't want that to happen. So I think that's also on that theme of real presence. Not just a metaphor, like, actually real presence is part of the thing too, with each other. Maybe another final thought too, just on the question of utopia, which is, go read that Jameson book on archaeologies of the future. I really like how he describes utopia, not as, you know, a magical future land, right? But he describes them as enclaves of resistance. And something Ben just said about, which for me is this really Marxist point of, you know, people make their history, but not always as they please. We always are only in the position we are in, which forecloses many possibilities, but opens up so many more. It's, you know, it's maybe that Hegelian thing of like a funnel narrowing down into a point, and then that point exploding out into all these possibilities. We're at that point. But that idea of utopia as being it's not escapism, right? Or real utopian thought, but it's sort of carving out a separate dimension where we're able to take a step out of that and see all those possibilities. And I'll just plug again, like, art and literature is so much of where this happens and so much of why they're necessary to help us, right? Like Jameson more on postmodern art, but just art in general, like, if it can affect that moment of spark of seeing something in a different way, that is just as powerful as a lot of other different types of revolution, and it's the start of a revolution. So
Everybody out. Без нас некому будет установить порядок, определить работу, и мы без нас все развалится, и все распадется.